Human Trafficking Hotline is now live to help victims and survivors get vital social and emergency services. If you need help or want to help stop human trafficking, call 1-833-900-1010.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. New York, this is Democracy Now!
Donald J. Trump of the state of Florida has received 312 votes. Kamala D. Harris of the state of California has received 226 votes.
On January 6th, Vice President Kamala Harris certified her own loss to Donald Trump in the 2024 presidential election. We'll speak with Pulitzer Prize-winning ProPublica reporter Josh Kaplan. He covered the January 6, 2021 insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, and as a major new expose headlined The Militia and the Mole.
I think anyone, even the most powerful people in the Republican Party, foresaw that Trump would be able to come back from this right after the Capitol riot. And just like he came back, there's been something else happening in the shadows. Militias that seemed at death's door right after the Capitol riot have been able to resurge.
Then acclaimed Palestinian poet Mossab Abu Toha, on his New Yorker piece, Requiem for a Refugee Camp, which focuses on Gaza's largest refugee camp, now in ruins, Jabalia. It's where his grandparents grew up. And as former President Jimmy Carter's funeral services begin today, we'll feature a clip of my interview about his new book, Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid.
Americans don't want to know. And the Israelis don't want to know what is going on inside Palestine. It's a terrible human rights persecution that is far transcends what any outsider would imagine. And there are powerful political forces in America that prevents any objective analysis of the problem in the Holy Land.
Speak with Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Greg Grandin about Carter's legacy in Latin America. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United Nations is warning its efforts to bring humanitarian aid into the besieged Gaza Strip are at a breaking point after Israeli forces opened fire on a World Food Program convoy over the weekend. Staffers documented at least 16 bullet holes in their aid convoy's three vehicles, saying the shooting left them terrified. Earlier today, an aid worker with Central Gaza's Man Distribution Center died from injuries sustained from an attack on the flour distribution site Sunday. Meanwhile, Gaza's health ministry reports another day of Israeli attacks has killed at least 31 Palestinians, injuring 57 others. Among the dead is the neonatologist Dr. Tabat Salim, killed in an Israeli strike on a house in the Nusayrat refugee camp just hours before her killing. The 30-year-old Dr. Salim had finished a volunteer shift providing care to women and children at Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital. Meanwhile, Physicians for Human Rights Israel reports Israel's military is refusing to reveal the location of Dr. Hussam Abu Safia, the jail director of Gaza's Khamel Adwan Hospital, and won't let his lawyers see him. This is Palestinian nurse Mohammed Al-Namnam, who was arrested alongside Dr. Safia when Israeli forces stormed the hospital December 27th.
We were treated violently and subjected to beatings. They don't distinguish. There's no mercy or any kind of humanity towards medical staff. The Israeli troops forced us to remove our clothes and they hit us with weapons and sticks.
We'll have more on Gaza later in the broadcast when we speak with the acclaimed Palestinian poet Mossab Abu Toha. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau announced Monday he's stepping down as leader of Canada's Liberal Party after mounting speculation and internal dissent.
I intend to resign as party leader, as Prime Minister, after the party selects its next leader through a robust, nationwide, competitive process.
Justin Trudeau has been Canada's prime minister since 2015, but faced plummeting popular support as well as opposition within his own party, with his finance minister, Chrystia Freeland, resigning last month amidst a public spat over how to respond to Trump's vow to impose a 25% tariff on Canadian goods. Freeland is considered one of the possible successors to Trudeau, as is close ally Dominique LeBlanc, who was appointed to replace Freeland in December. Liberal Party economic advisor Mark Carney and Canada's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Melanie Joly, are considered top contenders as well. Canada's scheduled to hold federal elections this year. Polls indicate Canada's Conservatives would win elections if they were held today. Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre, who's been compared to Donald Trump, has pushed anti-labor and anti-regulation measures and called for expanding oil and gas development. On Monday, Trump responded to Trudeau's announcement by posting on a social media site, "If Canada merged with the U.S., there would be no tariffs, taxes would go away, and they would be totally secure from the threat of the Russian and Chinese ships that are constantly surrounding them. Together, what a great nation it would be," Trump wrote on Truth Social. The U.S. Congress has certified Donald Trump as the winner of the 2024 presidential election on Monday. Vice President Kamala Harris oversaw the process of certifying her own defeat, acknowledging Trump's 312 Electoral College votes to her 226. Monday's ceremony came 4 years to the day after a violent mob of Trump supporters smashed their way into the Capitol, demanding then-Vice President Mike Pence refuse to certify Joe Biden's win. Vice President Harris said after Monday's certification she was simply doing her constitutional duty.
America's democracy is only as strong as our willingness to fight for it. Every single person, their willingness to fight for and respect the importance of our democracy. Otherwise, it is very fragile, and it will not be able to withstand moments of crisis. And today, America's democracy stood.
Lawyers for President-elect Trump have asked a federal court to block the public release of the report by special counsel Jack Smith into the Mar-a-Lago classified documents case and Trump's efforts to subvert the 2020 election. Trump's lawyers filed the request with U.S. District Judge Eileen Cannon, the Trump-appointed judge in Florida who previously ruled Smith's appointment was unconstitutional. Here in New York, Judge Juan Merchan has denied Trump's request to postpone his sentencing Friday. Trump was convicted on 34 felony charges of attempting to unlawfully influence the 2016 presidential election by falsifying business records to cover up hush money payments made to adult film star Stormy Daniels. Meanwhile, a federal judge declared former New York City mayor and Trump attorney Rudy Giuliani in contempt of court for failing to facilitate the handover of $11 million in personal assets he owes to election workers Ruby Freeman and Shea Moss. It's part of the $148 million defamation judgment the pair won after Giuliani falsely accused them of committing election fraud in Georgia in 2020. President Biden's issued new protections for U.S. waters, banning new drilling off the Atlantic coast, the eastern Gulf of Mexico, the Pacific coast off California, Oregon, and Washington, and part of the Bering Sea. While environmental groups hailed the move, President-elect Trump responded by vowing to reverse the ban immediately upon taking office and fulfilling his campaign promise to, quote, drill, baby, drill, unquote. It's not clear if Trump can do so without going through Congress. The U.S. has transferred 11 Yemeni prisoners from Guantanamo Bay to Oman, nearly halving the number of Guantanamo's remaining prisoners. None of the released men were ever charged or given due process during their more than 20-year-long imprisonment. Rights groups are calling on the Biden administration to resettle Guantanamo's last 15 prisoners and close the prison once and for all. Six of those remaining have never been charged with a crime. Three have been cleared for transfer by the Biden administration. The Pentagon's reached a historic settlement with some 35,000 LGBTQ veterans who were dismissed under the discriminatory Don't Ask, Don't Tell or similar policies, which forced military members to remain in the closet. Under the settlement, the discharge records of those affected will be restored from less than honorable to honorable, granting them access to veteran services and benefits they'd previously been denied. Don't Ask, Don't Tell was repealed in 2011. The city of Minneapolis has agreed to a federal consent decree mandating reforms to its police department. Under the agreement, Minneapolis must monitor and investigate allegations of police misconduct, limit the use of force, improve officer training, and respect protesters' First Amendment rights. Officials raced to finalize the agreement before Donald Trump's inauguration, as the former Trump administration opposed the use of consent decrees to reform police departments. The agreement comes more than 4.5 years after George Floyd was murdered by former police officer Derek Chauvin, sparking a global movement for police accountability, prison abolition, and racial justice. This comes just days after the Justice Department submitted its proposed consent decree over inhumane and brutal conditions faced by prisoners at the Fulton County Jail in Atlanta, Georgia. Dozens of prisoners have died there in recent years, including LaShawn Thompson, a Black man who is being held in the jail's psychiatric wing, where his family says he was eaten alive by insects and bedbugs in his cell. Chinese media are reporting at least 95 people were killed and 130 others injured when a large earthquake struck Tibet earlier today. Early reports from the region suggested hundreds of houses collapsed from the magnitude 7.1 earthquake. Austria could be ruled by a far-right government for the first time since World War II after the leader of the extreme-right Freedom Party, Herbert Kickl, was tasked with forming a new ruling coalition. This comes after Austria's main centrist parties failed to establish their own coalition government. The Freedom Party won Austria's parliamentary elections in September on a nationalist anti-immigrant platform, sending shockwaves throughout Europe. It was founded in the wake of World War II by former Nazis. Hundreds of protesters gathered in Vienna Monday.
Persecution of marginalized groups, mass deportations, cuts to social benefits, a return of a fascist state. We say that we have learned something from our history, but then at the same time, we elect a chancellor like Kicker and leave him in power. We have learned nothing from the past.
And the far-right ultra-nationalist French leader Jean-Marie Le Pen has died at the age of 96. Le Pen led France's National Front for decades, unsuccessfully running for president 5 times. He became the face of France's anti-immigrant extreme right and was repeatedly fined and convicted for hate speech and contesting crimes against humanity. His daughter, Marine Le Pen, is now head of the National Rally, formerly the National Front. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Congress has certified Donald Trump as the winner of the 2024 presidential election. On Monday, Vice President Kamala Harris oversaw the process of certifying her own defeat.
Donald J. Trump of the state of Florida has received 312 votes. Kamala D. Harris... D. Harris of the state of California has received 226 votes. This announcement of the state of the vote by the President of the Senate shall be deemed a sufficient declaration of the persons elected, President and Vice President of the United States, each for a term beginning on the 20th day of January 2025.
Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson grinned as he sat behind Kamala Harris. The certification took place on January 6, formerly a day of unremarkable procedure, and 4 years to the day after a violent mob of Trump supporters smashed their way into the Capitol, demanding then-Vice President Mike Pence refuse to certify Joe Biden's win. This comes as people who went to jail for their role in January 6 are asking President-elect Trump for a full and complete presidential pardon, including far-right Proud Boys leader Enrique Tarrio, who was convicted of seditious conspiracy. For more, we're joined by Joshua Kaplan, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for ProPublica, who covered the January 6, 2020 riot at the U.S. Capitol, has published a major new expose headlined The Militia and the Mole. His related piece in August is headlined Armed and Underground, Inside the Turbulent Secret World of an American Militia. His new piece is based on material provided by a wilderness survival trainer named John Williams, who was upset by January 6th and decided to go undercover in this same militia movement. He'd gathered 2 years of material, brought it to Kaplan to report on it. On Monday, Williams released another giant trove of materials on a website called Distributed Denial of Secrets. For more, we're joined by Josh Kaplan in our New York studio. Welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Talk about the significance of yesterday, where you were as you covered January 6th, and then who exactly John Williams is and the significance of his revelation to you, Josh.
Absolutely. So, I mean, after January 6th, which I think it's easy to forget at this point, was an incredibly violent day. I've you know, stood in the on the porches of Capitol Police members who adore Trump, but were just shaken by the beatings they saw that day, the attacks they saw on their colleagues. And after January 6th, history would have suggested, and a lot of militia leaders even thought, that the movement may not survive, that the backlash would be so intense that the militias would go extinct for an extended period of time. And they started to resurge in the years since and expand at a dramatic pace because, in large part, this is in some because of the policies of social media companies, but it's also because Trump and other prominent Republicans have embraced the January 6th rioters as patriots and political prisoners. And that's given the kind of license for these for people to join these groups again and to expand rapidly. And one thing that's changed since January 6th is that militias have become much more careful at keeping their activities underground. And these files that Williams provided give this incredibly candid, detailed window inside this underground. And they reveal how these groups have united convicted criminals with doctors, government attorneys, active duty police officers and U.S. soldiers.
And we know there were a number of active duty police officers and veterans and soldiers at January 6th in the insurrection.
Absolutely. No, it was they were disproportionately represented in that and in militias.
And at the same time, you have 140 Capitol and Metropolitan Police who were injured in this attack.
Absolutely. Yes. And then also one thing that came out in these files is the dangerous vigilante operations these militias have still been doing that they had managed to keep a secret. And that ranges from armed patrols at the border rounding up migrants to trying to crack down on voters casting absentee ballots, surveillance of local journalists and activists, assaulting Black Lives Matter protesters, and then also, lastly, in these files, there's this constant drumbeat of incredibly heated debate over whether they should escalate things even further and commit acts of mass political violence.
So you write, the documents laid out a remarkable odyssey. Posing as an ideological compatriot, John Williams had penetrated the top ranks of two of the most prominent right-wing militias in the country. So tell us who John Williams is. Talk about how you came in contact with him, why he gave you so much information over the years, and now has himself released a trove of information just yesterday. And who the groups are he was working with, from AP3 to a number of these groups.
Absolutely. So John Williams, he's a loner. He's extremely intelligent, well-read, introspective. He's also extraordinarily intense about almost every aspect of his life. And he had a tumultuous upbringing in young adulthood. He was convicted of a series of crimes that led to him spending 3 years in prison.
He lived where?
He lived in Utah. That's where he infiltrated these groups. And after he got out of prison, became a wilderness survival instructor. And that is how he says he first came in contact with these groups. They had hired him for a training. He tried to move on. And after January 6th, he was outraged and ashamed that he'd helped them in some small way. And he thought that, as he tells it, that the countless people would respond to this attack with aggressive action. And so he decided to reach back out and try to do a undercover operation of his own devising, as kind of a freelance vigilante.
As a freelance vigilante and kind of journalist.
Yes, yes. No, absolutely. And he didn't have a plan at first, but he is, I mean, another thing to know about John is that he's a extraordinarily talented liar, and that was the key to why he was so effective here. But you know, I was able to authenticate these files he had
now,
very carefully.
Now, he reached out to a number of journalists, but you responded.
Yes, yes. And so my relationship started with him towards the end of his journey in these groups, and I received this mysterious anonymous email that he'd sent to an array of reporters, and he didn't in this email say, "I'm an infiltrator who's gotten inside these groups." It was much more vague, but there was something intriguing about it. I responded, and you know, to be honest, I wasn't expecting much at first. I was skeptical, but we spoke a handful of times over encrypted calls, and then he sent me these files.
So talk about AP3. Talk about the Proud Boys. Talk about his rise in the militia movement in Utah, even as he is exposing it.
Yes. So so AP3, it's American Patriots 3%. This is I think people might be familiar with the 3%ers, and really the largest or 3%er group in the country for a long time has been AP3. And it's one of the largest militias in the U.S.
And explain why it's 3%. What does that stand for?
That's this based on the claim that only 3% of Americans fought in the American Revolution. And so it's this idea that a very small group of dedicated people can stand up to tyranny, which is what they see in kind of liberal governance. And he was able to, John was so successful at this that he ultimately got the head of the group's, of AP3's Utah chapter, fired, and then convinced people to put John in his place. So he was leading that group. He was sleeping in the home of the new leader of the Oath Keepers after the previous leader, the founder, went to prison for, was sentenced for seditious conspiracy for conspiring to violently overthrow the government on January 6th. And he was going through this guy's files another night. I mean, it's amazing. I listened to these tapes and I spent an enormous amount of time authenticating them. And he sounded like a completely different person on the call, just a brand new personality from the John I was speaking to on the phone. And these militia guys loved him, and it enabled him to lie and manipulate his way into the heart of several of these groups.
So talk about how the groups interact. And also, he was almost exposed when he actually reached out to warn a journalist that they were a target.
Yes, so there's a lot of interplay among these groups. I mean, I think a lot of lay people think of them like gangs. Like, you're a Proud Boy, so you're forever a Proud Boy. They're much more porous than that. People kind of cycle, but members will cycle between them. One group, and the missions of each are kind of ill-defined. That's part of why they've been able to grow so much. They're shared grievances, but when it comes to questions of, are we trying to overthrow the government, or are we trying to just police the border in our own dangerous vigilante operations, or are we trying to get involved in local politics? Those aren't questions that have predefined answers, and so there's constant debate about them, and it enables them to, in some ways, especially at the local level, bridge more mainstream conservative politics and more violent action. But the through line in all of these is paramilitary training, intense firearms training, where they will do things like practice storming buildings with semi-automatic rifles or doing an ambush with explosives.
What did he learn about the Salt Lake Tribune reporter?
Yes, yeah, so the reporter, so he was on a call at one point, and there was a conversation about, some woman started speaking about how there was a journalist in her small town who was covering the town's vice mayor who was under fire for a homophobic remark. And she thought this journalist was leading a secret far-left plot, and also was her neighbor, and she thought he'd been trying to harass her by leaving dead animals in her lawn. And so she seemed in the grip of something. And then at the end of this call, she said, I think I need to settle a score with this guy.
They're still neighbors.
They're still neighbors. It's getting to the deep state local level. It's got to be stopped. And this scared John. He felt obligated to warn this journalist. And so he sent him an anonymous email. The next morning, he saw an article posted online. The journalist had written 500 words about this experience and the strange email he'd gotten, and had a screenshot of the note. And there'd been some lines pointing, there's a lot of evidence pointing that John was the guy who leaked this. And so he thought, I'm finally found out. People are going to know I'm the mole. I'm going to go on the run. And so he picks up his life and flees to the desert, so he can disappear for at least several weeks.
So right now, we've just passed January 6th. President-elect Trump has called it a day of love. Enrique Tarrio, on January 6th, who was convicted and imprisoned for seditious conspiracy, head of the Proud Boys, has asked for a pardon. He actually wasn't there on January 6th. He was, picked up before January 6th? But explain the significance of that and where the Proud Boys fit into this story. And then the larger question, the visuals outside the jail where January 6th insurrectionists are held. There is a demand for a sort of global pardon of the protesters. President Trump, when asked by journalists whether he's going to pardon them, he said, not in the first 90 days, 30 days, like on the first day, in the first minutes. Not clear if it's going to be a blanket pardon or if he's at other times said it's going to be, he's going to look at each and every case.
Yeah. I mean, so the Proud Boys, to answer your first question, they're another militia group that is very much kind of sees itself as an arm of Trump, as a kind of the Trump street fighters, essentially. And their trademark until January 6th was fighting with activists in the street and kind of attacking people at left-wing protests. And they, according to the Department of Justice, were really, as much as any group, what led the charge that enabled the Capitol riot to happen, enabled the Capitol to be stormed. And so these pardons, the ramifications could be massive. They have the potential to trigger a renaissance for militant extremists, because there's no precedent for this kind of message of protection and support coming from the White House. And so if these pardons are as sweeping as Trump has repeatedly suggests they might be, if they include those who assaulted police officers that day, how that will be interpreted is that you can commit even serious crimes and not be punished for that, as long as you're doing it for the quote-unquote right cause.
And finally, going back to that affiliation with law enforcement, John Williams talking about how others in AP3 and other groups kept telling him, you can contact your local sheriff.
Yeah, I mean, these groups view that as critical to their success, having allies in law enforcement. The signature of these groups is putting themselves in incredibly volatile situations with a lot of guns. And so they want to have police, if not actively help them, at least leave them alone, see them as a friend.
They have a spreadsheet of the sheriffs that are friendly to them.
They have a spreadsheet. Every member in AP3 got a spreadsheet of the sheriffs in their state, was told to reach out to them, mark who's friendly, who's not. And they have these, you know, very detailed and kind of business school-esque tactics for buttering up police officers, buttering up sheriffs, trying to kind of pitch themselves. It's an incredibly organized effort that we don't, and in some cases has been quite successful, it seems. And we don't really normally get a view of that playbook, of those tactics, and how the sheer amount of work that they put into this.
And finally, as we look at what happened in Las Vegas with the